UCB Ireland, serving the church, reaching the nation.
Welcome to another edition of How on Earth Did We End Up Here with Nick Park and myself, Robbie Frawley. Nick, it is great to have you in the studio again. Episode 7.
Yes, we're racing through this, Robbie.
Thank you for being with us again. It's been fantastic, fascinating to see what we've been talking about in terms of church history. And today, we're going to look at chapter 13 of your book, How on Earth Did We End Up Here? And we're talking about how we ended up with Islam, Eastern Orthodox churches, and so forth.
Yes, because we've spent a lot of time talking about the Western Church. Mm. And in our last program, we did talk a little bit about the Nestorian churches that developed to the east of the Roman Empire. But we haven't really talked about the Orthodox churches, because they've had this misfortune, if you like, that for most of their history, they've been right at the interface between Christianity and Islam.
Yeah, and I suppose if you think about this, a lot of people would sit back and go, well, that's something that I don't quite understand. So on the basis I don't understand it, I'm not going to get involved with it. And I'm not actually even going to ask any questions. I would prefer to be ignorant of the situation.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of it. But I think also because most of the Orthodox churches, more so than in the West, tend to be catering for one nationality. So you'll have the Russian Orthodox Church, the Serbian Orthodox Church. So if you don't happen to be part of that nationality, you could actually really say, well, doesn't affect me.
So let's talk, if we can, about Constantinople to begin with. Let's go there. What's all this about?
Okay, well, when we think about the Roman Empire, obviously we think of Rome. Hmm. But actually, for most of the Roman Empire's existence, it wasn't Rome that was the centre of it. It was Constantinople.
So, okay. So, but I'm just thinking about all the Romans, they came from Rome.
Well, originally they did, but we need to go right back to our old friend Constantine.
Okay.
Because Constantinople is named after Constantine, the guy who decided he was going to be the first Christian emperor.
Yes.
You see, he wasn't a modest man, you know, to name a city after yourself. Modesty is not going to be one of your qualities. But the Roman Empire had basically become too large and too unwieldy to administer as one unit. And so Constantinople was designed as a second Rome to the east of the empire.
Okay.
And actually the Western Empire, it declined and finally collapsed in the 5th century. And that's why you have the famous book, the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, for example. But actually, for the next 1,000 years, the Roman Empire continued. There was still a Roman Empire, but its headquarters and capital was in Constantinople. Now, today, we tend to refer to that as the Byzantine Empire to distinguish it from the Western one. But actually, those people in Constantinople, they simply referred to themselves as Romans. They spoke Greek, but they viewed themselves as a continuation of the Roman Empire. And actually, Constantinople became the world's greatest city, far eclipsing Rome. In 800 AD... the second largest city in Europe was Rome, with a population of 50,000. Constantinople had a population of 250,000.
It was massive compared to Rome.
Much bigger. And it had a staggering array of arenas and palaces and churches and public buildings. In fact, a 13th century chronicler of the Crusades, he reckoned that over 8 centuries, Constantinople had managed to accumulate over 2/3 of the wealth and property of the entire world.
Wow.
Was centered in this city. And it had these walls. It had walls and moats that were 40 feet high and 4 miles long. And they were reckoned to be impregnable, that nobody could breach these defences. And also they had a wonder of the world called the Hagia Sophia, which was the major church in Constantinople. It took 10,000 workers and £20,000 of gold to complete it. And it was rumoured that its dome was so large that only God himself was holding it in place.
And none of this exists today, I take it. There's nothing left of it.
Well, actually, no, the Hagia Sophia still exists. If you go to Istanbul,
yep.
which is modern-day Constantinople. It was converted into a mosque,
yep.
but is now more, it's more like a museum. You can go in, you can visit it. I've stood in the Hagia Sophia, and it is still amazing and impressive today. But for a long time, the churches of Rome and Constantinople, they competed for being the headquarters of the Christian faith. And Rome, of course, had the historical associations with Peter and Paul. But Constantinople was the seat of the political power, and it was very much greater than Rome. And so what actually happened was you had the Western churches in Europe and North Africa. They still looked to Rome for leadership. But anything eastwards of that in Asia Minor, including all the cities where Paul had preached and, the churches in the Book of Revelation and all those places, they all looked to Constantinople. And in fact, at the Council of Chalcedon in 451, which is actually where we still get our definitive ruling on the Trinity from the Council of Chalcedon, there it was declared that the Bishop of Constantinople was of equal status to the Bishop of Rome.
It really did position itself.
Yeah.
As the lead city, really, in that respect.
Well, that's right. And this is
bigger.
Because we're in the West.
Yes.
This is a part of church history that we don't really know that much about generally,
yep.
and also because we don't belong to one of the nationalities that still have Orthodox churches.
Sure.
That's probably the main reason. But the fact is that they were both still tied to the idea of Christendom, of the wedding together of church and state. But probably the main difference is this. In Rome, because of the decline of the Western Empire, the church became the boss in the church-state
sure.
arrangement.
Yeah.
But because Constantinople was still powerful politically, the state continued and the church was very much the junior partner in that relationship.
Wow. How did we end up with the rise of Islam?
Well, in the Eastern Empire, you already had a lot of wars being fought against the Persians and the Slavs and people like this. And Constantinople eventually worked out that rather than fighting wars, they would rather buy people off. So if there were tribes that wanted to invade Constantinople, they would just give them a load of money.
Okay.
Because it was a wealthy city, they could afford to do that. The problem was that when Islam developed, they couldn't do that because Islam was not motivated so much by a desire for loot
yep.
as it was promoting an ideology.
Sure.
And Islam began with Muhammad, of course, who was yep. a camel trader from Mecca. And he founded this new religion in the Arabian Peninsula. Now, if you just look at a map of the region, Arabia is very much cut off on its own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a land connection, but it's very narrow.
Right.
And so this was a bit of an isolated area, and you got a lot of heretical Christian cults that had developed in that region. And one cult actually said that the Trinity consisted of God the Father, Mary is God the Mother, and Jesus is God the Son.
Okay.
And actually Muhammad, reacting to these, not actually Trinitarianism, but tritheism. It was the worship of three gods, effectively. Muhammad reacting against that, he reinterpreted the Bible to develop this fiercely monotheistic faith. And at first, in the early days of Islam, people did not view it as a different religion. They viewed it as a Christian heresy or as a cult that had derived from Christianity, and it was only much later that people began to treat it as a separate religion. And it spread throughout the region, but very often it spread through violence. Now, way back in 2006, Pope Benedict gave a speech that caused a lot of controversy. He said that Islam was a violent religion which was spread by the sword. And of course, what happened was there was outrage around the world, and churches were bombed and burned, and people were shot, and protesters called for the Pope to be executed. Apparently, they all did that to prove that Islam isn't a violent religion.
It's strange.
But what what the Pope didn't really say at that time was Islam was simply following the example of Christendom, because the church had already been advancing its cause by violence at this stage. And Muhammad basically picked up on that, and he just did it more effectively. And so he waged this war of conquest in the Middle East, which found many people then being forcibly converted to Islam. And so Islam began to grow. And because it was in the East, Middle East, because it was so close to Constantinople, you had Islam becoming the deadly enemy of Christendom, mm-hmm. and more particularly Eastern Christendom, which was centered in Constantinople.
Right.
So gradually you had continual wars and invasions, and the territories that the Eastern Empire controlled around Constantinople, they shrank and they became smaller.
It's a very interesting thing because I have been in situations where I have been invited into homes, and when I was living back in the UK, and the hospitality of the Islamic neighbours that we had, mm-hmm. just staggering, unbelievable. Come into our home, be part of our home, you are the guest, please sit here. And just incredible acceptance.
Yeah.
I go through phases, okay? This is probably gone a little bit off track, but I go through phases. I'm sure many, many Christians do go off phases where I don't quite understand this. And because I don't understand it, I'm afraid of it. Mm-hmm. And because I'm afraid of it, I will never talk to that person.
Well, here's the deal. When you're talking with an individual Muslim, be the a neighbor,
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to judge that Muslim by the standards of what Muhammad was doing,
yeah.
or what the Islamic Empire was doing, mm-hmm. hundreds of years ago, would you like to be judged by them on the basis of what happened during the Crusades,
no,
or
not
the
a
Inquisition?
Chance.
So,
yeah, not a chance.
So we need to look at individuals and realize when we're talking about the historical development of the religion, that doesn't necessarily have a bearing on your relationship with an individual Muslim today.
Well, that's always it's a good way to point that out. It's a good thing to bring to the table because we are living neighbor to neighbor,
yeah,
and we've got to do the right thing.
Well, yeah. Now, going back to the history of it a bit,
yeah.
One of the reasons why Christendom did not cope well with the rise of Islam was because of this division between Western and Eastern Christianity, because of mm-hmm. the divide between the church headquartered in Rome and the church headquartered in Constantinople, because they were no longer part of the same empire, and they did their theology in different languages. So in the Western Church, they were doing their theology in Latin. In the Eastern Church, they were doing it in Greek.
Okay.
And things didn't always translate quite as easily as you might have wished. So there was misunderstanding, and they began to issue rulings against one another, and there were theological disputes. And then in 867 AD, there was a dispute over who was to be the patriarch of Constantinople, over all of the Eastern Church. Mm. And the Eastern Church tried to excommunicate the Pope in Rome, which obviously didn't go down well.
No.
Also, you had other pagan tribes in the Balkans, you know, what today would be Yugoslavia, for example.
Yeah.
Some of these tribes were now converting to Christianity. And to be honest, both sides competed. Like, were these tribes going to be Western, Latin,
sure.
Christians, or yeah. were they going to be Eastern, Greek Christians? So you had a territorial squabble going on. And that's, you know, that still affects the world today. When we think of all the horrible things that happened in the former Yugoslavia,
yeah.
and we still have the war trials and stuff taking place
still
in The Hague
on.
And everything else, a lot of that was to do with the religious differences between the Serbs and the Croats.
Yes.
Because the Serbs were Orthodox, the Croats were Catholic.
Yes.
One was Eastern.
And one was one Western.
Was Western.
Yeah.
And so even a lot of the disputes and the genocides and the slaughters all stemmed from that basic difference. Now, all of this came to a head in the 11th century. And you know what? It often happens in religious disputes that the straw that breaks the camel's back is something rather petty.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in the 11th century. And it all came down to the bread that they used in their communion services.
No.
Seriously. The Western Church was using unleavened bread, whereas the bread used in the Eastern Church contained yeast. And because the Jews used unleavened bread in the Passover, the Eastern Church got a bit anti-Semitic and said, oh, you're being too Jewish.
Whoa.
And so there was all these delegations sent to one another. And finally, a cardinal sent by the Pope strode into this big Hagia Sophia church in Constantinople during a service and slapped a declaration on the altar declaring that the leaders of the Eastern Church were excommunicated. And the Eastern Church responded by excommunicating the cardinals and everything else. Now, actually, here's the funny thing. Because travel and communication took much longer in those days,
sure,
the excommunication wasn't even valid anymore because the Pope who had issued it had died before it could be delivered. But nobody knew that. And so basically the dispute passed the point of no return. And this event in 1054, it's known in history as the Great Schism, where now the two churches had probably in reality been separate for a long time, but now it was official. You had the Roman Catholic Church, you had the Eastern Orthodox Church, and each one of them claimed to be the true Church of Jesus Christ. Now, just remember this. At this point, the Eastern Orthodox Church was still powerful. Mm. Constantinople was still the richest city, and the church, the Eastern Church, had over 1,000 bishops just in Turkey. Never mind other parts of the Middle East. But now the continued attacks by Islamic forces reduced this more and more.
It's amazing. Just to get to that point, you think, that's what happened.
Yeah.
And that's how it all unfolded.
Yeah.
And that's how we ended up with this situation that it's the follow-on from that point.
Yeah. So because you had the church so divided between East and West, eventually, Constantinople fell.
Yeah.
The city fell. Now, it really began with the Crusades, because the Crusades have often been presented as a case of the Western Church helping the poor Christians being persecuted in the East. But the fact was, it merely widened the schism. Because when the Crusaders arrived in places like Constantinople, they found that even the Christians, the way they dressed, the way they spoke, their habits and their manners, they looked more like the Muslims than they did the people in Western Europe.
Okay.
And so the Crusades were tremendously expensive, and the Crusaders looked at all this gold and all this wealth in Constantinople. And basically, there was a combination of internal politics, distrust of the Orthodox Christians, and just plain old-fashioned greed. And so the Crusaders actually sacked the city of Constantinople in 1204. And it was an orgy of murder and rape, and priceless artifacts were carried away. The churches were desecrated. And French soldiers actually put a prostitute on the throne in the Hagia Sophia Cathedral in order to dance and sing obscene songs. So, I mean, this was a point of no return.
And this was all done in the name of Christianity.
This was all done that they were there on this crusade, guaranteeing their places in heaven and fighting for the kingdom of God. It's crazy. Then, as the Islamic threat increased, people realized, if we don't join back together again, we're going under. And several times, several Eastern emperors requested military help from Rome to combat the Islamic forces. But each time, the price was, we will only help you if you acknowledge the Pope as the supreme head of the church. And sometimes the Eastern emperors would agree to that. And when they tried to sell that deal to the population, the people just wouldn't wear it. And what happened, even this, the Russian Orthodox Church became so fed up with the weakness from the leaders of Constantinople that they actually said, no, the capital of the Eastern Church is no longer Constantinople, it's Moscow. And the Russian Orthodox Church would still describe Moscow as being the third Rome.
Wow.
After Rome and Constantinople. And then finally, in 1453, Constantinople was captured by the Muslim Turks. Because now with gunpowder, the Turks had heavy cannons.
Yeah.
And those big, thick walls were not impregnable whenever you brought cannons against them. And so this was actually when the Roman Empire finally was finished. It was in 1453. And from that moment forward, the lands of the Middle East and North Africa, which had played such a major role in the early centuries of Christianity, this now became what we know as the Islamic world.
It's 1453, you say?
Yes.
Now, that is, I know, a long time ago, but it's not really.
Well, it's only about a quarter, you know, since then, about three quarters of the history of the Christian church up to that point.
And Rome was still very much in charge up to that point. Now, I know by 1435, it had collapsed. But to 1400, it was still there. It was still doing its thing.
It was still there. It was still powerful.
From the point of Jesus.
From the point of Jesus up until then, or certainly from the time of Constantine. But now Orthodox Christianity continued in very different forms. You still had a lot of Orthodox Christians living under Muslim rule. And there, their numbers continue to decline. And that's why you tend to have small Christian communities in many predominantly Muslim nations.
Okay.
And one of the reasons for this was that they felt that God had deserted them. Because here's the thing. In the old days of the Roman Empire, you had this thing, we've talked about it in an earlier program, about the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church.
Yeah.
But it didn't work like that under Islamic rule. And the reason was because once the church had gone down the route of waging wars in the name of God, then what happens if you lose those wars? It's one thing to be the innocent victims of persecution. It's another thing that you wage a war and you say God has told you to do it, and then God gives the victory to your enemies. And so you had a lot of the Christians in the in what is now the Middle East converting slowly but surely to Islam. But meanwhile, the Orthodox Church continued among the Slavic peoples as national churches. And so today you have the Albanian Orthodox Church, the Bulgarian Orthodox Church, the Georgian Orthodox Church, the Macedonian Orthodox Church. Now, one of the problems with those churches has been that when you tie your Christianity in with nationalism and love of your country, you create an idol. The two become very much joined together. And true Christianity can often take a back seat and patriotism becomes more important. Yep. And your Christianity basically becomes basically just propping up national pride.
Sure.
And stuff like that and politics. But this strong link between nationality and church affiliation, this is why Eastern Orthodox Christianity has never really produced modern missionary movements like Protestantism and Catholicism.
Sure.
Because you can't really go to Africa and try and persuade people to join the Serbian Orthodox Church.
Yeah, they're not interested.
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't. No.
So now you have this struggle between Christianity and Islam. And you know, for a long time, it looked like Europe would be overwhelmed altogether. You had, for example, Islamic forces conquered the majority of Portugal and Spain. And a majority of the people living in southern Spain were Muslim.
Really?
At one time. Islamic forces conquered Sicily and Crete and began pushing into France. And then there was a pivotal battle took place in 732 AD at the Battle of Tours, which is whenever French forces overcame a large Muslim army.
Okay.
And so there was a process took place. It took another 770 years for the Muslim armies to be expelled from Spain.
That's crazy, known
as the Reconquista. And after that, the Muslim forces of the Ottoman Empire conquered much of Eastern Europe, such as Greece. And actually, many of the Orthodox Christians, they weren't too unhappy about this. They would rather have the Muslims over them than the Western Christians. In fact, one Greek politician said it this way, better the Sultan's turban than the Cardinal's hat.
Huh.
And so the Ottoman Empire declined eventually and was finally ended by the First World War. But actually, this interface between Islam and Christendom, it's become much more to the fore now, of course, with immigration.
Yes, it has.
And and groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and stuff like that. And also, we've seen the decline of Christendom in the Western world. Not the decline of Christianity, but the decline of Christendom, where the church is the dominant force in society.
It's a good thing to actually separate those two, Christianity and Christendom. Yeah.
So to a lot of people, this can look like, well, Christianity is declining, Islam's growing, Muslims are taking over.
Yeah.
It's not actually true. It's not. You know, you do. First of all, you don't have large numbers of people converting to Islam.
Right.
Nowhere do you have a Muslim Billy Graham standing in a stadium and loads of people coming forward to acknowledge Muhammad as their prophet.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen. What you do have, obviously, people who are Muslim immigrate into Europe. But the fact is, even the most radical estimates that say that there isn't any European countries going to end up with more than 15% of their population being Muslim in the next 100 years.
This is what's actually now come out. This is a survey that's been done that says this won't happen.
Yeah, so you're talking about a minority, a large minority.
Mm-hmm.
But also what we're seeing is this, that when Muslims immigrate to Europe, a lot of their second generation and third generation, their children, their grandchildren, actually become nominal Muslims.
Okay.
They're not as, they become more secular. They become more European. The same factors that are making Europe secular affect people from so-called Muslim families as much as people from so-called Christian families.
They just get wrapped up in the world around them.
Yeah. And the problem is, whenever Christians began really acting out of fear, because God has not given us a spirit of fear. He's given us a spirit of boldness and love and a sound mind. And when we stop panicking and saying, oh, what are we going to do? The Muslims are taking over. We can actually realize that God's doing something quite amazing. He's bringing people often that we cannot reach in their own country, and he's bringing them to a place where we can share the gospel with them.
Openly share the gospel.
And we're seeing some amazing thing happens. I mean, as we said already, you don't have large numbers of nominal Christians becoming Jews.
Yes.
Or becoming Muslims.
Yeah.
But you do have large numbers of nominal Muslims becoming Christians. So that in Finland, for example, 10% of all Muslim immigrants into Finland are now members of evangelical and Pentecostal churches.
And that's a massive thing for them. Of course, a massive thing because they're born again and they've given their lives to Jesus. But if you go back into their generation, though, that's a huge thing for them and a big, big problem for them in terms of their family and their life and their even a threat upon their life.
Yeah, but despite that, people are still converting to Christ in huge numbers. And so I think if we stop looking at this through the eyes of fear and look at it through the eyes of faith, we see that actually Muslim immigration into Europe represents an amazing opportunity to share the gospel with people we couldn't otherwise reach.
You're listening to UCB Ireland, serving the church, reaching the nation.
Patrick's Shrined Bell. Gospel goblet and simple brass bell, Comalkill took from Patrick's grave. Holy clog that broke the druid's spell, its power can heal but cannot save. That tocsin toll so feared by royalty, blessing hindered the bell hidden behind beauty, kings reclaimed loyalty, faith well controlled, if not forbidden. Not filigree patterned glowing gold, not gemstones securely embedded, but the gospel of hope, simply told, is what the Celtic kings so dreaded. And bell then buried in an oaken ark, guarded from priest, common thief, a Victorian spade hit the mark, an anxious antiquarian's sighed relief. Shrine hidden bell, hold its breath, behind museum glass tourists stare. Some declare St. Patrick's death, but others pray his breastplate prayer.
fantastic poem to open up what we're going to talk about very soon is Celtic Christianity. The poem is entitled and by?
It's by my friend Louis Hemmings.
Yeah.
And it's called Patrick's Shrined Bell. And it's about a bell reputedly belonged to St. Patrick that was discovered and is now on public display.
That's fantastic. So let's talk about Christendom and missionary mandates and also Celtic Christianity. We've arrived.
Yeah, we've arrived. The Irish have come on the scene at last.
The boys are here.
Yeah, it's how we ended up with missionaries, basically, is what we're talking about. Because, you see, we said way back in our first program, we said that God's original intention was for the Church of Jesus Christ to take the gospel to the ends of the earth.
Yeah.
And the gospel, by its very translatability, is wonderfully suited to be adapted to every human culture anywhere in the world. But this is where Christianity and Christendom pull in opposite directions. Because Christendom, by its very nature, is tied to individual political units, such as nations or empires.
Yeah.
And the whole emphasis is on looking inward, you know, binding the in-group together, good Christian citizens. And those who live outside your borders, by very definition, they're outsiders who can't share in the benefits of citizenship and church membership. And according to this mindset, the best way to evangelize outsiders is to conquer them through crusades or wars of religion.
Okay.
And you reach this absurd place where you have wars going on and you've got the clergy on both sides praying for God to give victory to their armies. And, you know, as if God has a split personality.
Yes, like, yeah. It's a draw.
Yeah. And when the church and the state are joined at the hip, why would anyone question whether God is on their side? But you look at world missions and the history of missions and you see a struggle because you have this Christian gospel full of life and by its very nature, it seeks to branch out and spread. But then you have the dead weight of Christendom trying to stop that happening. And it's significant that the first great missionary expansion of the church, it did not happen because of a church hierarchy decreeing, let's go and send missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
It actually happened in a very organic way. Most major missionary breakthroughs in history occur because of accidents, coincidences, or because an individual somewhere felt impelled to go and preach the gospel. Very rarely do denominational executives have anything to do with missionary innovation.
Right.
And after the day of Pentecost, the church was centered in Jerusalem, even though Jesus had said, you know, you got to go be my witnesses to the ends of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only persecution that scattered the church out of Jerusalem after the death of Stephen. And the gospel quickly spread. It went into Ethiopia, it went into Europe, and churches were established in North Africa and Syria and in Persia. But with the establishment of Christendom under Constantine, the emphasis was on building a Christian empire, not taking the gospel to new fields. And it was actually the groups that were seen as being a bit on the edge or a bit heretical, like the Nestorians, who actually took the gospel to other places, took it to China and India and places like that. But then to the West, another mission field opened up. And it was not sent by official legate sent out.
Uh-huh.
It was through Patrick, a slave from Western Britain, most probably modern Wales, who was kidnapped by Irish raiders, forced into slavery, and even though he eventually escaped, he could not forget the darkness and superstition that dominated the Irish people. And so Patrick came back as the apostle to Ireland. And most of us know the great story of how he stood on the Hill of Slane in Easter 433 AD and looked over the Boyne Valley. And the Druids had said that no fires were to be lit in the kingdom that day until the king himself had lit a fire in honour of his pagan gods.
Yep.
And instead, Patrick lit a bonfire. And the Druids cried out, "This fire, which has been lighted in defiance of the royal edict, will blaze forever in this land unless it be this very night extinguished." And they failed to extinguish the fire that night, and the fire has continued to burn in Ireland ever since.
See, that's the something that we forget about our Irish history and our spiritual Irish history. We forget that one man chose to do something extraordinary, chose to go against the grain, chose to do something that the whole of the area would see and declare God as who he was.
Yeah. And as a result of that, you ended up with this Celtic church. Ireland actually was the only nation in 1,000 years in Europe that did not become majority Christian because the king became a Christian and commanded all his subjects, but it became majority Christian simply through the preaching of the gospel. Simply through one person telling another person and so on about the power of Jesus to change their lives.
And again, it makes you proud to be Irish.
Yeah, not the kind of nationalism that we want to fight people.
No, I don't mean in a wrong way.
But proud that God could do something like that in this little country.
Yeah, and like you say, the only place in 1,000 years that it wasn't commanded that you become Christian.
Yeah.
That it was Christian through choice.
Yeah.
People became Christians because they wanted to.
Exactly. And this Celtic church, I mean, it grew beyond Ireland. It actually established centres in Iona in Scotland, in Lindisfarne in northern England. And these Celtic churches would exercise great influence because, you see, Irish monasticism was different from Latin monasticism because the monastic centres were not places of retreat from the world. They were mission stations that prepared missionaries to go out into the world. And this all coincided with a period of confusion and lawlessness in Europe, because you had the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. You had various barbarian tribes coming in and butchering people and burning down churches and all this kind of thing. And then you had these pioneers such as Columba and Aidan and Columbanus and Killian, mm-hmm. who spread the gospel all over Europe. You had Celtic missionaries travelled as far as Iceland and Russia. And it's even thought that one of them, Brendan the Voyager, went all the way to America.
From here, with the gospel.
Yeah. And it was a tremendous movement of the Spirit. And now some historians have questioned how much the Celtic Church was really distinct from Rome in matters of doctrine. And we still have today, both Catholics and Protestants want to claim St. Patrick as one of their own.
Sure, yeah.
But the real difference about the Celtic Church was not actually to do with its doctrines, but it was its distance from the seat of political power. Because the Celtic monasteries were perched on the edge of and even beyond the empire's crumbling borders. So they weren't invested in trying to prop up the power of the emperor. They were invested in preaching the word of Jesus. And so they were able to concentrate on the conversion of unbelievers to Christ rather than supporting the church-state project. And these Celtic monasteries, they became centres of learning where the scriptures and actually many other manuscripts were copied and distributed. Mm-hmm. There is a wonderful book that's worth reading. It's by an American historian called Thomas Cahill, and it's called How the Irish Saved Civilization.
I like the title.
And he shares how these monasteries didn't just preserve the Word of God, they preserved mathematics, they preserved literature, they preserved history, and they just became centres of learning at a time whenever Europe was descending into the Dark Ages. Now, eventually, as Christendom re-established itself across Europe, Celtic Christians were persuaded to toe the line. And in the end, they lost their missionary zeal. Mm-hmm. And then in the 12th century, Henry II of England, he was authorised by the Pope to invade Ireland and to force the Irish Church to conform to the rule of Rome.
Okay.
And to adopt the practices of the English Church. And that was formally ratified at the Synod of Cashel in 1172. And that's really when we see the end of this flowering of the Celtic Church, and the Church in Ireland came once more part of the church-state project of the Latin Church.
Before we move on a little bit, I want to ask you a question, and it's off the book. It's not nothing to do with the book, okay? Places like Glendalough.
Yeah.
You could, I love Glendalough. It's beautiful. Yeah. And I go down there on a regular basis. I don't know how many photographs I've taken in the last year of being there, but it's a monastic city, what's left of it, okay? And you hear all of these St. Kevin and all of these stories. But how true to Christianity were places like that, are you aware of?
Well, many of these places were actually pagan centers of worship beforehand.
Yeah.
And basically they became Christian centers of worship.
Right.
And you know, that does happen. You know,
as
people abandoned the old pagan gods and embraced Christ, I mean, it wasn't done by violence. It wasn't done by the sword. It was very much a people movement.
Yeah.
And you see the same thing today. There are parts of the world, for example, there in Pakistan, you have actually mosques there where everybody in the mosque has converted to Christ.
Wow.
Not by the sword, but by the preaching of the gospel. And you have basically the imam is now the pastor.
Amazing.
And the mosque meets as a church and worships Jesus. So we had something similar happened in Ireland as these pagan sites became instead centres of Christian worship.
Yeah. But
I mean, listen, it wasn't perfect.
No.
You know, people were still feeling their way with biblical truth.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of good went on and a lot of genuine preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Let's talk about Latin America.
Okay, because that was another area of where the expansion, if you like, of the church. Because you now had Columbus rediscovered America. Now, of course, the Native Americans would say, well, we were there all the time, so how could he discover it when we always knew it was here?
We knew we were here, yeah.
Yeah. But basically, as European nations began to establish colonies in America and Africa and Asia, often you had forced conversions going hand in hand with colonialism.
Right.
Now, way back in 2007, Pope Benedict caused a real media storm. He was giving a speech in Brazil, and he made the claim that indigenous peoples in the Americas had been silently longing for Christianity whenever the priests first arrived. And actually, in one sense, he was correct, because the religions they had in what we now know as Latin America before Christianity arrived were incredibly cruel. You had the Mayans who would rip the hearts still beating out of the chests of human sacrifices.
No way.
You had Aztecs who are estimated to have offered 20,000 human sacrifices a year in their ceremonies of other people that they had defeated in battle, basically. So you could argue that any religion that came to Central and South America was an improvement over that. But the reason why the Pope's comments caused such controversy is because the arrival of Catholicism in America, Central and South America, coincided with the wiping out of entire civilizations.
Mm.
Now, some of this was down to disease because, you know, Europeans had, for example, smallpox, chickenpox, measles, and had built up immunity over generations.
Yep.
But the people in America had no immunity. So as soon as they encountered these viruses, they died in huge numbers. But you also had the colonialists massacring large numbers of peoples and enslaving them as they basically raped the continent of South America, trying to extract as much gold and silver as possible and using the indigenous peoples as slave labor. And you did actually have colonialists who justified this by saying, well, we've given these natives, as they called them, the greatest benefit of all because we've given them eternal life by forcing them to be baptized. So therefore, it's only just fair that we can enrich ourselves from their land.
We can take something for our trouble.
As a reward for how we've blessed them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And is this about slavery in the New World now? Is this part of that?
It is. This is part of that. Now, one thing people often ignore is that there was actually heroic efforts from missionary priests to try to stop this slavery happening. And you had constant friction between the conquistadors, who needed slave labor to mine and transport gold and silver, and you had mainly the Jesuits, who actually sheltered the natives and persuaded authorities in Europe to condemn the colonialists. So you actually had the governments of Spain and Portugal, they passed laws to prohibit slavery. And there was a, in 1537, Paul III issued a papal bull which condemned slavery and excommunicated slave owners and slave traders. But tragically, what happened was the civil authorities in South America fought against that, fought against the Jesuits, and used their money and used their influence against the governments in Europe and church leadership in Rome. And so they had their way in the end, because what happened in Christendom was that gold spoke louder than truth and justice.
Wow.
And so Central and South America became what we know as Latin America, with most of the inhabitants speaking Spanish or Portuguese. And it also became a continent where Roman Catholicism was the dominant religion. But it was a strange form of Catholicism. It was very what we call syncretistic, where a lot of pagan practices and traditions were incorporated into it.
And this would have been because of their culture at the time.
That's right. It was just basically incorporating aspects of their pre-existing culture.
What about China? Because we are in mission now. We're talking about this. So let's talk about China.
Well, again, this was another early mission field, but you didn't have the colonial thing. You didn't at this time, we're going back now to the 1500s, 1600s. You didn't have Europeans ruling China at that time. Now, the Jesuits sent out a guy called Matteo Ricci, and he actually reached Beijing. He was the first Westerner to ever enter the Forbidden City in Beijing.
Okay.
And he actually became an advisor to the emperor's court. And one of the things that the early missionaries did to advance their influence in China was it was actually their skills in science and mathematics, because they could predict things like solar eclipses and stuff like that.
Okay.
And they helped the Chinese to develop better maps, clocks, telescopes. And so another Jesuit, Von Bell, he actually became the highest ranked scientist in the Chinese court at the time. And what happened was, in fact, this is just a little bit of a side, but you may remember a few years ago, there was all this fuss about blood moons and eclipses.
Yes, yeah.
And,
we had one recently.
Yeah, and rather foolish Christians saying it would heralded the end of the world and all that kind of thing. I actually made a comment at the time that years ago you had Christian missionaries use their skills and their knowledge of astronomy to advance the gospel and impress unbelievers. Today we've reached a stage where we have some Christians getting laughed at unbelievers because we ignore science and technology. Yeah. So we've, in some respects, we've gone backwards.
Yeah, we have. We have. We've become afraid of things we don't know.
Yeah. Now, one of the things the Jesuits did was they actually used Confucian concepts to explain Christianity, just like Paul did in Athens when when Paul talked about the unknown God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the Jesuits did something similar. The Chinese said there was a Lord of Heaven. So he said, God is this Lord of Heaven. And by using these concepts and putting the gospel in a Chinese context, they actually won over 250,000 Chinese converts, not by the sword, but by preaching. And, you know, it's really tempting to think how different Chinese history might have been if that had continued. But what happened was Christendom, it always messes things up, you know, because you had competition between different monastic orders. And some of the other monastic orders persuaded the Pope that the Jesuits' methods were an ungodly compromise and that the Chinese emperor had to repent and pledge allegiance to the Pope. And as a result, the missionaries were expelled from China and the Chinese converts were persecuted and many of them were massacred. Now, then you had Protestant missions.
Right.
So you had the Moravians who sent out missionaries to so many places. You also had William Carey, who was known as the father of modern missions. He was a shoemaker from Northampton.
Okay.
He made a map of the world out of shoe leather and used to pray over it as he worked.
Wow.
And he actually shared with some fellow Baptists they had a desire to take the gospel to the nations. And he was told, young man, when God pleases to convert the heathen, he will do it without your help or mine. But he refused to be deflected, and one of Carey's sayings was, "Expect great things from God and attempt great things for God." And so he set up a missionary organization. Now you had missionaries traveling to many different parts of the world. One of the problems was the missionaries, the only way they could get access to other parts of the world was through the colonialism and through the colonial authorities. And so in many parts of the world, missionaries became linked in people's mind with colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it was difficult to say, were they advancing the cause of Christ or were they advancing the cause of the British Empire?
Right.
In fact, Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Prize winning Anglican Archbishop in South Africa, he said this. He said, "When the missionaries came to Africa, they had the Bible and we had the land. And they said, 'Let us pray.' And we closed our eyes. And when we opened them again, we had the Bible and they had the land." Which is very profound.
Very, very profound. Yeah.
Now, having said that, look, there were many missionaries who were sacrificial, who were devoted, who genuinely served others, laid down their lives on the mission field. I mean, there were incredible amounts of missionaries died in a short space of time because people didn't understand malaria. They didn't understand about it coming from mosquitoes.
Right.
It was just known. It was fever. And so you had thousands of missionaries who would sometimes study for 7-8 years, go to a mission field and die within a few weeks.
Because of malaria or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet they kept on going. And sometimes they may have been old-fashioned in their methods. They may have been stiff upper lip, uphold the British Empire types,
yeah,
but still incredible sacrifice and bravery.
They went.
Here. They went. But other missionaries developed innovative message and methods of sharing the message. So one example is Hudson Taylor.
Yes.
Who set up the China. Most listeners will have heard of Hudson Taylor.
Yeah.
He encouraged his workers to adopt Chinese dress and customs. And he famously said, "If I had £1,000, China should have it. If I had 1,000 lives, China should have them. No, not China, but Christ. Can we do too much for him? Can we do enough for such a precious Savior?"
Hmm.
And he preached the gospel in China. And at that time, you have to remember, Britain was fighting something called the Opium Wars, which was where they were using military threat to try to force the Chinese to accept opium that the British were trading to them.
Okay.
So the British were basically the biggest drugs dealers in the world at this time. And the British Navy and Army were reinforcing that. So you had the missionaries coming alongside these people to preach the gospel. It obviously was not easy.
No.
And there would be great opposition.
Massive
and
battles.
Great suspicion because you were linked with this inhumane practice. But overall, the 18th and 19th centuries missionary efforts, they were a mixed blessing. I mean, yeah, the gospel was taken to many nations and the seeds were sown for future growth. And many missionaries did display heroic self-sacrifice. However, often the missionary organizations were very paternalistic. They wouldn't permit national workers to hold leadership positions of any significance in the church. And missionaries did often work hand in glove with the secular colonial authorities and often assisted policies that were racist and exploitative. Now, they brought Christianity to many parts of the world, but they also brought Christendom with them.
Right.
But the beauty of this is that the gospel cannot be contained. And so they did bring the gospel to many places. And it might not always have been done perfectly. It might not always have been done well. But they sowed a seed. And today that seed is bringing forth an amazing harvest in many parts of the world.
It is fantastic to just look back at church history. We're almost at present day, which it's just incredible how we've journeyed. Nick, if somebody wants to get hold of the book, tell us how that we can get hold of it.
Well, the paperback copy is available simply nickpark.ie. You can order it online. It's postage free anywhere in the world.
nickpark.ie.
Yes. If you want the ebook, the Kindle ebook, just go to your Amazon site, search either for Nick Park or. Now, if you search for Nick Park, you will get a lot of books about Wallace and Gromit and
Shaun
the Sheep. Just somebody did ask me this the other night who'd been listening to this program. No, I'm not the same Nick Park. But if you look up How on Earth Did We End Up Here on the Amazon search, you can buy your ebook there.
Wonderful. Looking forward to our final look into church history next week, when we begin to look at liberalism,
evangelicalism.
Evangelicalism. Couldn't get my head right, and more besides. Nick, until next time, God bless you. Thank you.
Amen.